Oh, let's get it.
But anyway, I think the tape should be up enough now. It's Paul Rodell once again, and I'm sitting here with Robert Yates. Do you use Bob rather than Robert, or do you use Robert?
Bob, usually.
Usually Bob, and usually using the middle initial M. And today is June 20, that I had to write down so I wouldn't forget. Bob was in IVS from 1957, at least through 58, maybe a month or two into 59. First in Iraq for 3 months, and then shifted over to Vietnam for 21 months, and I'm going to ask you about that. But before I do, start off with just asking you one question, and for most of this, I'm not going to be talking. It's going to be up to you.
Okay.
Although I may interject to ask a clarification or something like that. You know, if something is unclear to me, just to get it nailed down a little bit more. But the first question, as I told you before I turned on the tape, got beyond the yellow sheet that we sent out, because we didn't have much room in four pages. So the first thing would be, you know, where and when you were born, something about your family, parents, siblings, and, you know, where you went to school, how you developed as a person that led you toward the direction that you took in your life, at least to get you started into IVS. And I'll turn this thing around so that there'll be no problem with the voice level for you. And
okay.
Go to it, Bob.
Well, I was born November 9th, 1928 in Trenton, Tennessee, county seat of the county. Mm-hmm. One of the foremost agriculture counties in the state. My father was an assistant postmaster, Cecil Yates, and he married my mother, Elise McDermott, Scotch-Irish background, and my dad was from English background, as far as I know.
Mm-hmm.
And he was Methodist and she was Cumberland Presbyterian, and when she became Methodist, we were raised in Methodist church. Practically everybody in that town goes to church. If you didn't, you wouldn't tell anybody about it. And
yeah, I know.
Anyway, there was in that town, there was Methodist, Baptist, Presbyterian, and Church of Christ. That was about it. And many other churches are there now. But anyway, during the Second World War, my father let me go to be with my mother's brother in Oklahoma on a farm. Mm-hmm. So I did a lot of farm work, and I decided that farm work was more fun than anything, so I wanted to be a farmer.
Uh-huh.
And I told my dad I didn't want to go to college, I wanted to be a farmer. Mm-hmm. He said, well, at least you should be an educated farmer, so I recommended, I was adamant that I was going to be a farmer.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, you should be an educated farmer. And so I said, well, I want to go to Oklahoma and learn to raise beef cattle. So he said, well, tell you what I'll do. He says, I'll let you go for your first 2 years in Tennessee, and then you can go to Oklahoma if you still want to. So I did, and so I finally went and went to Oklahoma A&M. And after I got out of there, I went to Nebraska. Got a job teaching veterans. That lasted about 6 months, and that was called into the Naval Reserve, which I had enlisted in high school. And after I was in the hospital corps in the Navy, and after that was over, I went back to college and got a master's in poultry and poultry nutrition. And there I met a lot of people from different countries, foreign countries, and I enjoyed learning about them, and So one of them, is a friend of mine from East Pakistan, now Bangladesh.
Uh-huh.
A Muslim, well, of Muslim origin. He was more of a Marxist, as he put it.
Mm-hmm.
But we argued all the time about various things. Politics, of course. He enjoyed arguing, and so did I. And we became very good friends, even though we had opposite views on most things. Anyway, he suggested that I join a volunteer agency, IVS. He saw an advertisement. He showed it to me. And
huh?
So he said, why don't you join this? If you can't find anything else, you know, after graduating. So I looked around. I didn't see anything on the horizon. So I sent in, and they accepted me.
Wow. Now, let me get to some of the chronology straight.
Okay.
When was the bachelor's? When did you get that one? Just to backtrack a little bit.
I got the bachelor's in 1959.
Okay. And that was an ag background?
Yes.
For
poultry, nutrition, and not, no, animal husbandry.
Okay.
Animal science.
And then there was the Navy stint for a bit.
And then I went to, after that, I went to Nebraska to teach veterinary agriculture.
Right.
And that was just for only about 6 months, until the Navy found out where I was. And
oh, I see. That's
they
right.
They didn't know where I was because they thought I'd had stayed there in Oklahoma. And then they thought maybe that I'd gone back home to Tennessee.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started going to the Naval Reserve meetings in Nebraska, so they finally got a trace on me.
Right.
So then they got a letter to me and told me that I was to report to to Chicago, Great Lakes Naval Training Center.
Uh-huh.
So I was in there 21 months, and after that Eisenhower decided that it would save money if get as many people out of the service as possible after the Korean War was over, and that was in 1959, must have been in 59, anyway.
Okay.
I can't.
Oh, that's all right.
I can't think of it.
And then, then you went and got the master's.
Yeah, I got the master's, yes.
That was what, Oklahoma?
Oklahoma.
Okay.
And, let's see, I graduated there. I finished in 56, and then I went to, with IBS, and I guess in February or January of 57.
Mm-hmm.
And they were going to send me to Vietnam, but then they decided to send me to Iraq. I got over to Iraq, and IVS canceled their contract in Iraq after about 3 months, and I was transferred to Vietnam.
So it wasn't that the IVS was kicked out; they just had
to cancel their contract.
Someone else canceled the contract with IVS.
I think IVS they mutually agreed to cancel the contract
because
they weren't getting along politically.
Yeah.
With the government. The government was changing.
Oh, okay.
You see?
Yeah.
They didn't want to have any more things to do with the Kurds, I think, was one of the big things.
That's right, because I was interested in that. You said you worked with the Kurdish people.
Yeah, and the Arabs didn't want to support the Kurds anymore, and we worked better with the Kurds than we did the Arabs.
Did you like them? As people?
Oh, yes, I like both of them, but, I mean, they had their own political agenda.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
The Kurds are more like more like Americans. Than the Arabs. The Arabs are, for instance, the Kurds have dogs. Arabs don't want to be seen. They don't have anything to do with a dog.
Uh-huh.
The dog is unclean,
uh-huh.
And they have a lot of they have different customs. The Kurds are they tend to be more light skinned. They look more European than the Arabs, than most of the Arabs do, especially in Iraq.
Okay.
They're all different nationalities living there. So many of the nationalities that speak, they speak Arabic are really not Arabic blooded people, but they may be from some of them anyway from Central Asia.
Oh yeah, right.
They were brought in by the Turks when the Turks came in.
Right, right.
They more or less assimilated into the Arab society.
Mm-hmm. So that was a very short stint. That was,
yes,
you hardly got your...
About 3 months. I just barely learned Arabic.
And then had to learn Vietnamese.
Well, I learned more Arabic than the Vietnamese. Vietnamese is harder to learn.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you get any very much preparation for this shift to Vietnam, or was it
no,
just into a plane pretty much?
It was pretty sudden.
Uh-huh.
It was pretty sudden. I had known something about Vietnam before I went it at all, because I thought I was going to Vietnam to begin with.
Oh, okay.
So I got some of the politics and idea of both sides, but it was quite a shock when I was transferred out there.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, I imagine. Yeah, I didn't know if they might have given you some language or some culture lessons or things like that.
They did no language lessons, but there was some cultural lessons that I got before I went to. They sent me some stuff to read.
Uh-huh, okay.
IVS sent me some stuff to read.
So that may not have been adequate, but it was something
to
soften the blow of the transition.
That's right.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that was kind of an amazing thing to go from one part of the world like that to another.
it was.
Very different.
Culture shock.
Yeah. What was some of the culture shock when you first got in Vietnam? What were some of your first impressions that you had?
Well, I had come from a country where it was hot and dry.
Mm-hmm.
At that time of year, it wasn't that hot when I left Iraq. And then we went over to Iran. I spent a day in Iran, in Tehran.
Okay.
The capital, and that was kind of a culture shock because people were much more European looking there than they were in Iraq, and much more modern, and
even though
it was much cooler, it was a lot of cooler and a lot more moisture, so it was a. Another culture shock, and then we flew into Karachi, Pakistan,
uh-huh.
And that here again we came back to dry country with camels and the whole thing. So it was similar to Iraq again, and then the next landing was in steam in Vietnam.
Oh, dry.
It was about 100 degrees, and the humidity was probably even higher than it is today here.
Oh, yeah.
And quite hot, and I could hardly get my breath. However, I acclimated very quickly to it.
Living in a sauna, or a steam bath.
That's right, a steam bath, you might say. And it rained every day there about the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Sometime it rained 15 minutes. Seemed like it went 15 minutes early every day. And then it reversed and started going 15 minutes late, the rains came.
Uh-huh.
And then we went into a dry season. We had only one rain, about one rain a week. So it was a culture change for sure, but and we didn't have in Iraq we had tapes to learn the language. In Vietnam we worked with had lessons from interpreters, and sometimes with the structure was not it was not structured. It was just sitting down and talking with them, and more or less had your own program, did your own program. It wasn't very structured.
Not really professional language teachers.
No, these weren't professional language teachers.
Yeah.
So there was a lot to be desired there as far as learning the language. But we learned to talk with the people. Some of us, Tom Lucci could talk like a native.
Really?
In
I hope to be
in Vietnam, Vietnamese and French.
Ah, how good!
And he could has the correct accent, and his vocabulary was extremely huge. So,
how many other folks came over with you from Iraq?
None.
You were the only one.
None. Mm-hmm. The other people from Iraq were had almost completed their 2 years, and they were on their way back.
Anyway.
They were on their way back.
Yeah. Okay.
And one of the guys, they wanted to get out of Iraq as soon as possible. He was. They told him that he's to work with the Arabs now, and he said no, he wasn't going to do it. He came back to work with the Kurds, and he wasn't going to do it. And so they were trying to get him out because he was politically liability, you might say.
Becoming too pro-Kurdish?
Mm-hmm. He was. He had become a Kurd almost. Completely brainwashed.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, what were some of the other kind of culture shocks other than the heat and the language transition? What other sorts of things impressed you, either positively or negatively?
Well, I don't know. I guess it's sometimes if the political situation was in both of these countries, you don't get into and you don't talk a lot of you don't do. It's not good to do much political talking.
Uh-huh.
And with anybody, you don't have the. But there's always some people that want to talk politics, and so even in Vietnam there were people that wanted to talk politics. For instance, the Buddhist people were they didn't too much like the president of Vietnam because he was of course he was Catholic and he was pushing the Catholic people up to prominence.
Mm-hmm.
And so they didn't like that too much, and some of the people thought even though that they should be cooperating with the North Vietnamese more than they were, so there was you could see how they how some of the people felt, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And of course these were young people and they thought they didn't have enough liberties, so they felt like that they should be able to dance all night and play as much as they wanted to without the government interfering.
Mm-hmm.
And calling curfews.
Oh, there were curfews?
Well, there was curfews, I think, after 1 or 2 o'clock, you were supposed to be at home, you know.
Okay.
In bed, which I thought was a good idea myself.
Yeah. But by 57, 58, do you think the country was pretty much making progress at that time?
They were making some progress. Yes, I think they were making some progress. However, the Viet Cong of the underground Viet Minh were continually raiding and continually working to establish one Vietnam under Bac Ho,
and
Uncle Ho.
And this was even 57, 58.
Yeah,
they were pretty active?
They were active, and they were becoming, and they became more and more active as time went on.
Uh-huh.
And the president of Vietnam, South Vietnam, Ngo Dinh Diem, he had his hands full. He was fighting the, I can't think of the name of it. It was the extreme Buddhist group. The Wahao.
Well, they were kind of like
They were fighting the Wahao because the Wahao was a real radical Buddhist group that was wanted to bring militant Buddhism to Vietnam. And they even was one of the guys that he told people if they drink such and such a stuff that they would become invisible when they went into battle.
Uh-huh.
They couldn't be killed.
Well, I don't know.
And they found out that this wasn't true.
Yeah.
And so we could even hear the battles, well, the Wahao, in a distance, you know, maybe 10 to 15 kilometers from where we were.
But you were in Bon Ventoux, weren't
you? I was in the south. We was in several places. We were down what they call Khai San, which was down in the this was when we were first got there. We went to Khai San.
Okay.
And the Khai San was down in the delta.
All right.
The delta of the Mekong.
Yeah.
And we went up down the canals in these motorboats. Visited every kilometer, there was a canal that went went east and west between off of the Mekong and off of the other rivers that flowed from the Mekong. When you get to the delta, you see that you have several different little streams coming from the main Mekong, main river. So these were lateral canals every kilometer. And so we were canal three, Kinh Ba, number three canal. That's where we lived. And we lived on a houseboat there the boat was just a raft with a house on it.
When you say we, who do you mean we?
The IBS team.
Oh, who was in your team along with you?
The Par Danforth who headed it up.
Ah, I heard that name, yeah.
And he was a Quaker.
Uh-huh.
He never said anything unless it was needed to be said.
Uh-huh.
No idle chit-chat. Then there was Bill. I can't think of his name. And Gene Myers.
Uh-huh.
And myself and Arzella Bawi, who and Millie Scaff. They were nurses. These two ladies were nurses. And oh boy. I'm trying to think of the guy from Wisconsin. Big tall guy from Wisconsin. I can't think of his name right now. And so
what, you said Bowie for
B-O-W-E.
B-O-W-E.
I think it's, they call it Bowie. And she married one of the interpreters.
Okay, I've got a note on her. She is deceased now.
Yeah, she's deceased. She died of cancer in California.
Okay. Who were some of the others again? I just wanted to look up where they are living now. Because I had a little address list here.
Bill is, I can't think of Bill's last name right now.
Okay.
He went home early because he just said this wasn't for him, that he was not... He was not a do-gooder. He just wanted to travel. And,
yeah, I know. It's a tough way to travel.
Yeah. And he kind of enjoyed it, but he only stayed there for about 4 months or so.
Uh-huh.
And the one guy I can't think of his name. And then...
Well, Danforth, by the way, is deceased as well.
Well, I would imagine he is. And
he was living in California, in San Francisco.
Uh-huh. And let's see. I'm just... anyway, what happened is they decided to, because of the threats from the... Viet Cong, Viet Minh, we called them in those days. They decided to unite. There were two teams, one in Ban My Thuit and one here at Khai San. So they were going to unite the two teams.
Oh, okay.
And so Par Danforth also wanted to quit, and so he resigned. And so the team was moved up to. We met the rest of the team in Saigon.
How come he wanted to quit?
I don't know why he wanted to quit.
Okay.
I think he thought he was misled for some reason like that. But anyway, so the two teams joined and... Dick Cagle was the other guy.
Dick Cagle.
Dick Cagle. He teaches in University of Wisconsin in Madison.
Oh,
I believe.
Yeah. How do you spell that name again?
K-O-G-E-L.
K-O-G.
Cagle. Something like that. I'm not sure.
Okay.
I'm not sure.
All right.
Yeah. So, anyway, that was... the team in Ban My Thuit, well, it was the Ban My Thuit area.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, the team headquarters was north of Ban My Thuit at a place called Halan A, or Halan A,
mm-hmm.
you say in English.
Yeah.
Well, it could be Halan Bay. I don't know. I'm not sure. I forget. Anyway, so that's when I met Brock Miller and this Art King,
mm-hmm.
a black guy who's now passed away.
Mm. Too bad.
And then there was Paul Worthington.
Oh.
Paul Worthington is now passed away. He's drowned. At another station, been swimming, I believe. His wife is carrying on with IBS.
Oh, that's right.
I forgot her. She was.
He was actually in AID when he drowned, I think.
Yes, probably. He probably was with AID.
Yeah, and I heard that his wife was working in the IBS office at least before, not any longer. I don't think.
But she was very active in.
What was the black guy's name?
Art King, A-R-T-K-I-N-G.
Oh, okay. All righty.
And
Because I had heard that name
Art
before.
Art King went home early. He didn't fulfill quite the 2 years, but he had,
and he is now deceased as well.
Not deceased, yes.
Yeah.
And of course, then there was it was Gordon Bruckman, of course.
Yep.
And his wife, he brought his wife. He had married. He got special permission to bring his wife. And they said, well, sure, just as long as there's not any pregnancy.
Uh-oh. You know,
she was pregnant when they came, and she didn't know it. Anyway, and so they had their child there.
Uh-huh. And that
and the leader
didn't get in trouble, huh?
No, everything worked out fine. There was he was a Mennonite. There was a Mennonite leprosarium nearby, and
uh-huh.
that's where and they had doctors and nurses there, and so that's where the baby was born in the Mennonite leprosarium. So they were with home folks, you might say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When the baby was born, and let's see. John Barwick, John and Laura Barwick were leaders of the team there. John was the leader of the team. His wife. Mike was also with him, and he was there for years in Jordan in Palestine.
This is, what was his name again?
John Barwick.
Barwick.
And John Barwick has now passed away, along with Laura, his wife.
My goodness.
And at the time, John was, he was probably 60-something years old when we were there.
Oh,
so
uh-huh.
He was,
yeah.
He was of retirement age at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And John was, he gave us some ideas, but a lot of his ideas were, he wasn't really into it.
Oh, yeah?
He was there on vacation mostly, it seemed like, to me. But he did a lot of he kept up with the paperwork. There was a lot of paperwork to be done, so he kept that up.
Uh-huh.
Did that. And Gordon Brockmiller and Paul Worthington and Tom Lucci.
Mm-hmm.
They were the three kingpins, you might say. Of course, Dick Cagle was also a strong person, but in there, and then of course Gene Myers later on was very involved.
You know, I'll be seeing Lucci later.
Yeah.
So I'll
say hello.
I sure will.
I mean, I've been wanting to see him.
Mm-hmm.
But
I'll make a note of it right now. He's living in Virginia, by the way. In Reston, Virginia.
He was living in Maryland
when
I last saw him, right north of Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, let me see something else. Oh, we were going to the villages.
Mm-hmm.
To the refugee villages, and we were talking with the people and getting them to new ways of raising chickens. We had a problem with the chickens in that they sent these USOM, which is later became AID, getting the chickens for us from Japan. These were American, these were European type chickens, but they were coming from Japan, and they would send some feed along with it. And later I determined through some research that the A, B, and E had been destroyed by rancid, the feed had become rancid, and it had been destroyed by rancidity. And we felt that this might have been a communist plot so that the chickens would all die, and many of them did just all die. The only ones that did well were the ones that where the guy didn't use the American feed; he used his own feed.
Gosh. Well, why did you suspect some tampering?
Well, we just thought there would be anything to discredit the Americans would be going on.
Oh, okay.
So
I thought maybe you had some.
No, that's the only thing. But it should have been some antioxidant or something in the feed to prevent that. But it was slightly on the rancid side, but I didn't think it was that rancid. But
mm-hmm.
There could be something, because I checked it out, and it's the ADE efficiency,
uh-huh.
which is the fat soluble vitamin deficiency, and that's what is destroyed when a feed becomes rancid. So, but anyway, we worked with the villagers and were helped them with their, some of them helped them with their gardens and introduce new crops such as Ramey, which is a kind of a flax. You make what they call grass linen out of it.
Mm-hmm.
We introduce new varieties of sweet potatoes and other things like that.
Were sweet potatoes already part of the diet?
Oh, yes, but we had newer and better varieties, faster-growing varieties that we...
And it was an accepted part of the diet?
Accepted, yes. Well,
okay.
They accepted most everything except cheese or any milk products. They don't accept the milk products. Some of them just, they got a surplus cheese from America, and they were trying to use it as soap.
Trying to use it as soap?
Yeah, trying to wash with it because they felt, what is this stuff?
Oh, it couldn't be edible because it tastes terrible.
Yeah,
so let's wash clothes.
So they gave it to us. We would give them stuff, and they would give us this, all this cheese. Says, if you can find a use for this, please accept it. when we were down in Kaesong, we were making reports as to how many buffalo we saw in the area. And the local Vietnamese people that were getting surplus buffalo and everything to distribute to the refugees were taking these buffalo, and the buffaloes were not getting to the refugees, is what I'm trying to say.
Uh-huh, okay.
And so they had, politically, they had wanted us out of there. So instead of us being threatened by the Viet Cong, the Viet Minh, I think it was politically these local people wanted us to get out of, because they were slaughtering these buffaloes and selling the meat to the Americans.
You mean provincial officials?
People working with the program, the resettlement, the refugee resettlement program, the Vietnamese that were working.
Okay. I thought maybe local political leaders.
Well, you always have a lot of corruption in every government, and here was something going on that that they didn't want us to. We were making reports today to USAM, and USAM was going back to their people, and it was getting by, you know. So we didn't realize that our reports were being damaging the Vietnamese people there.
Mm.
And but they, it was, and so we think that was one of the reasons. That, these are all some of the things.
That would anger them a bit.
So USAM kind of wanted us to get out of the villages.
Uh-huh.
And some of the politics was, on the top level, they wanted us there to help the villages, but on the down on lower level, we were too close to the, they wanted to keep a lot of things secret, so that's one of the reasons I think they wanted us out of the villages, and they wanted us to...
keep it secret from who?
From the big but Ngo Dinh Diem and his group.
From their own government upstairs.
Yes, that's right.
And not necessarily the American.
Because they were, because they didn't want, because there were some, people were enriching themselves.
Okay.
On all levels here.
Uh-huh.
There were a lot of people enriching themselves through the U.S. aid.
Mm-hmm.
And so most of them were not thinking about anything more than two or three days ahead, you know.
I mean, yeah.
They weren't thinking of the future of the country or the future of the people. They were more or less thinking of themselves, what they can get when the getting is good, while the getting is good. And so then they, USAM decided that they wanted to have a farm in which they would produce seed to distribute to the villagers.
Okay, and sounds like a reasonable idea.
So we were to be the workers on this farm, which we did not agree with and which we didn't sign up to do, which angered us, but we went along with it.
Well, why didn't you agree? Did you think it was a bad idea?
Well, not so much, but we were to have personal relations with the Vietnamese people.
Gotcha.
To make friends, and we weren't. We weren't making friends with these villagers. We were cut off from the villagers. We weren't talking to the village leaders. See, this is exactly what these other people wanted us to prevent.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't want us talking to the other people and to find out what was going on at the local level.
Right, right.
So, when I left, the team was withdrawn to Saigon, and we were going to have a big headquarters in Saigon, and they were going to work out of Saigon. Everybody was going to be quartered in Saigon with different people stationed around the country at various places, working kind of independently. But here, we were going back to these, but working on these kind of farms or experiment stations, you might say. So that's the way it was when I left.
Yeah, just let me clarify, just so I make sure that I understand what you're saying. I think I'm clear. The switch over from the refugee work to the seed farm would have been maybe sometime in early 58, something like that.
Early 58, probably.
And you were really more interested in trying to do people-to-people work.
Right.
And that had been prevented by Vietnamese officials?
Well, working with the USAM.
So they convinced USAID types that what they really need was a seed farm.
Yes.
Put those volunteers and isolate them on the seed farm.
Yes. That's just kind of what they, to my thinking, the USAM was cooperating with them in order to keep the program going.
Okay.
Because...
better to sacrifice you than sacrifice the program.
Yeah. And see, at that time, No Dinh Diem was a straight shooter. But his brother right next to him
knew,
and his wife, they were crooks.
Yeah.
They were working with the corruption people.
Mm-hmm.
And they had power, but No Dinh Diem would not believe anything bad about his brother.
It was his tragic downfall.
Yeah. One of his downfall. Maybe he knew, but he didn't want to face it.
Yeah.
But then he had another brother that was a cardinal or archbishop or something there.
Mm-hmm. At least a bishop
who was pushing the Catholic agenda.
Right.
And, of course, No Dinh Diem was a Catholic, and he wanted to push the Catholic agenda, too. But he was, at the same time, he was trying to strengthen the country, you know. And so he was playing a lot of agendas going for him. And then the Americans came in, and they had an agenda, too, you see, which complicated the things.
And then there's local officials with their own agendas.
and the local officials in the old time, you're right, the local officials, they were pretty much dictator of their own province or their own state.
Okay.
And you have to cater to those guys, too. You must remember politics has to be played with them. And the local official the governor of our province was very upset that we had not come to call on him and pay our respects. But we did not know enough of the politics that we should do this.
Make that
and
courtesy call.
We weren't instructed by Saigon to do that.
Yeah.
So,
because Saigon, why wouldn't Saigon have told you to do that?
Well, they probably thought it wasn't necessary.
This is Saigon, the Vietnamese government.
You see, the Vietnamese Saigon and the American Saigon, they were pretty close.
Uh-huh.
They were talking to each other all the time. So, but you see, No Dinh Diem, he wanted tight control of the whole country. He wanted a centralized government.
Right.
However, these people in the provinces wanted a state's rights type of a government.
Okay.
Or province rights type of a government.
Yeah, extremely
provincial rights type of a government. And so there was not a meeting of the minds here.
Do you think you were caught in the middle?
We were pretty much caught in the middle. And as time went on, we learned these things.
Do you think that was why Saigon didn't tell you to say, you know, to drop in and give your respects to the local
head? They had no idea what was going on in Saigon. Saigon was something like Washington, D.C. Washington, D.C. doesn't know what's going on in the country.
Okay.
Because they don't get out to the boondocks enough.
No, I thought maybe they wanted to give the provincial head a snubbing by not having you go there.
I don't think so. I think
really?
They just
completely oblivious.
I think they were oblivious to what was going on to anything except Saigon.
Okay. All right.
They got reports, but it was from like a foreign country, you know. I mean, it was like from...
Yeah.
You know, they got... because I don't think enough of them went out to the bushes, to the boondocks enough that they got a feel.
So it might have been a report from the moon.
But because when we went to Saigon, we got all together there. We went to Saigon like every other week.
Yeah.
And we got a completely different idea about how things were going. But see, another thing, we were passing information on to the Americans and to the Vietnamese what was going on in the boondocks. And some of the people in the boondocks didn't want that information going anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, they would be more interested in keeping Saigon very ignorant
that's
of everything.
Right, that's right.
Yeah, yeah, because then they won't be bothered by the central government.
And they'll be making their money and doing their thing and paying off their people, and and everybody will be happy. They will probably be dealing with the communists at the same time. And everybody was changing their money with the communists, because you could get about double for your money, for your American dollar, as you could if you did on the level, if you did it straight with the government.
So they were doing black market money changing.
We were doing it too.
Yeah, but I mean the
everybody was doing it.
The Viet Cong,
The Viet Cong was buying American dollars, paying us double for what the Saigon government would pay for at the bank.
I find that amusing.
Yes.
I mean, you know, looking back.
And this one guy who was head of IBS, Dr. Knopfsinger, they caught him changing money.
Oh, really?
it wasn't with the communists per se, but just with a shopkeeper, maybe. That was doing it, you know.
Just to make some money.
To make him some money.
Yeah.
And the shopkeepers were doing it with the Viet Cong men. Of course, they didn't know or care who they were. As long as they were making money, they didn't care. So this was everybody was responsible for what was going on. Of course, we would have all been in big trouble if they would have caught us, but they chose to look the other way. I'm sure they knew what was going on, but everybody chose to look the other way, which was, we were all at fault for that.
So, anyway, you didn't want to do the seed farm, but you did anyway.
We did anyway.
Yeah. You know. And that, you worked on that for how long?
I seemed like to me 6 to 8 months, something like that. I don't know.
That was to the end of your service?
Yeah, but you see, toward the end. Uh-huh. But gradually we were getting back.
To the individuals?
To the individuals.
Yeah.
And we were, where we could, we worked with the individuals too.
Where was the seed farm?
Out from Bamituat.
Oh, so in that area.
A place called Buon Ho.
Okay.
And that was the people. The other people that were involved here were the Mount Danyar or the Ra Day, which are of a. They are related to the Filipinos and to the Indonesians. And they have a different language altogether than the. Many of them are very primitive. These were the people living there when the Vietnamese came down from China and took over the country 1,000 or so years ago.
Yeah. So what was your working with individual farmers? What was that like? What were you doing?
Well, we would just, I would go in and talk to a man give him some, say we would like to give you some chickens, and then we would like to tell you how we have found the best way to raise them is, you know, and And so he would say, oh, that would be very nice. I would like to have some chickens, but I already know how to raise chickens, but you can tell me whatever you want. If we agree and I want to do it, we'll do it.
Yeah, just like
we'll go for it.
Like a farmer working an extension agent with an extension agent anywhere else in the world.
So. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And so, anyway, some of the people believed everything we said, and those that did went out on their own sometime were profited a little bit better.
Uh-huh.
Because they knew their own country and they knew their own people and how things go. But one of the biggest successes was Art King's working with pig farmers. And some of these pig farmers made lots of money with Art King's and Brock's. He got also involved in
Brock Mueller.
Brock Mueller.
Uh-huh.
Idea of how to raise pigs. And
what did they do different?
Well, they pinned them up for one thing.
Okay.
And then they fed them a different diet.
Uh-huh.
A balanced diet that they worked out themselves. Sweet potatoes they couldn't sell, or rice bran. Rice bran is really, really good.
It's highly
nutritious. And other things, and how to prevent disease, and vaccination programs, and animal health programs, and things like this. They did a lot of good in this area. Brock Mueller also worked with before I got there, he worked with chickens too, and he worked with me with chickens to a certain extent. But he worked with chickens and hogs and I think cattle as well.
Mm-hmm. So was it a lot of farmers who adopted this, or was it one or two in particular who really took off?
I can just think of one or two that adopted. Actually, when these guys became quite wealthy, you know, all of a sudden, there's a lot of them was ready to go with it. But then they pulled us out of this and started on the seed farm, and we really we were upset about that.
Yeah.
And let me see, it was Lucci and Tom and Paul Worthington that were working with improved crops and improvement in crops. You're supposed to pitch the garden things like garden crops like sweet potatoes and squash and food crops like that and peas. And we went over and introduced black-eyed peas, and we found out that the people had already been eating black-eyed peas. In fact, that's where black-eyed peas came from. It was from China and Vietnam, places like that, was their origin of it. And so our new varieties of black-eyed peas did real well there. And so
And so it was just an improvement on the local.
Then when they got the seed farm, they asked me to work with something, and so I chose rice. I felt like new varieties of rice would be a good idea, so I tried to get them to introduce some of the rices that we had been developed by them in the Philippines for Highland rice. They grew Highland rice differently. You sow it like you would corn, you know. And you have to weed it with a hoe or something. So
this is all for upland.
All for the upland stuff. And I knew nothing about rice, but I learned something about it. And then they told me that we should test before we introduce rice from the Philippines, that we should test the Vietnamese rice and to see if what we could do with that. Well, the Vietnamese rice, there was no improvement by the end of the way we we raised it, and actually the Vietnamese probably had more insight on how to raise open rice than we did. So the best thing we could have done was to give them the improved varieties and let them go with it.
Mm-hmm.
But
did they? Did you actually do that?
I think eventually they did, but that was after I left.
Okay, all right.
I think eventually they did. That was the plan. And we were to get these varieties from the Philippines that had been produced and had been from Los Baños, the university there in the Philippines. So, and this was many years ago.
Yes.
58. Now, I left there almost the first day of 59.
Yeah, because the IVS record said 59. And you had written 58, but I guess really it was so early in 59,
Day, I think New Year's Day is the day after. We left Brock Miller and myself and some more people. Can't think of who they were, left to go back to the States on the boat. We decided that we were going to go home to the Lucia, I think. We'll take a slow boat. And we all went together as far as Ceylon.
But didn't Brock Miller come back again?
Oh, yes. He re-upped.
Oh, I see. So this was a vacation home?
He re-upped and he decided to, after he got back to the States, to sign on again.
Mm-hmm.
And Lucci got a job with working in Washington for a while, and then he went with the AID or USAM for a while, and then he's been with volunteer agencies, and so then Brock Miller came back to Vietnam as team leader when John Barwick retired. John Barwick, I think, left about the same time we did. Yeah, he left the same time we did. But he left by air.
Mm-hmm.
And he went where he was doing by air.
I think I would have preferred the boat.
Yeah, well, yeah. Well, John was in more of a hurry, and they actually went to India, and so I almost, when I was in India, I almost ran into them. I saw that they had signed a register the same day, but I missed them. I went to Agra. We were both in Agra at the same day.
Oh, really?
But I missed them. I tried to see them.
Uh-huh.
But then I visited John Barwick and his wife in New York on my return to the States.
They probably don't have him listed in the volunteer group here.
John Barwick?
Yeah, because they wouldn't have the staff in here.
Yeah, well, he was a...
Oh, no, the John W. Barwick, and it says 57-59.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
He left the same day we did.
Uh-huh.
Approximately the same day we did.
Wonder if you might still be in contact with him.
Oh, John is long dead.
Is that so?
Yeah, that's how many years ago.
Oh, that's right. You already said that. Both he and his wife, Laura. I'm sorry.
In the 60s then.
Goodness gracious, yes. No, you already told me that.
He'd be pretty close to 100 or better.
Uh-huh. Were the Viet Cong ever a real problem for you in an immediate sense?
No, not really. I knew some people that were, I didn't know them, but we saw people that they said were Viet Cong.
Uh-huh.
We didn't ever knew that they were or not.
Of course, maybe then they were still calling themselves Viet Minh, I don't know.
Well, Viet Minh, they did call them.